ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Get involved. Vote now in the search for Australia's favourite wildflower
at abc.net.au/science. Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National
and at abc.net.au/science.
In Lebanon, nearly 100,000 people have fled Israel's bombing of their towns and villages as it retaliates to attacks from the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah.
Officials say more than 250 people were killed overnight when Israel launched over 100 strikes across the capital Beirut in just a 10-minute window.
Israel's defence minister insists there is no ceasefire in Lebanon and his country's military will not stop its attacks.
The conflict between Israel and Lebanon that began on the 2nd of March, 2 days after Israel and the United States began their attack on Iran, is not new. Despite having no border disputes or a struggle over resources, these two nations have been in a constant conflict for decades. And while the United States is trying to broker a ceasefire, few in the region are hopeful. Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince, and in this Rear Vision, the story of Lebanon and its relationship with Israel. The border that separates Lebanon and Israel came into existence after World War I and demarcated the boundary between the French Mandate over Greater Syria and the British Mandate over Palestine. Mireille Rebiz is the director of Dickinson College, associate professor of politics at the University of Otago, and the author of several books on Lebanon.
There's no doubt that the borders there in that region were artificially born because they were drawn by the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And in September 1st, 1920, the French General Gouraud drew the map of Lebanon and basically dissected Lebanon out of Syria. So Lebanon was actually part of Greater Syria. The question of the statehood of Palestine and the borders of Palestine is a little bit more complicated.
In 1947, the United Nations passed the Partition Plan for Palestine, which was to divide Palestine into two independent states, one Arab and one Jewish. But in 1948, a Jewish state was declared unilaterally by David Ben-Gurion.
Britain told the UN it would terminate the mandate within 6 months. British responsibility ended on May the 15th, 1948. On the same day, amid scenes of great emotion, David Ben-Gurion proclaimed the independent state of Israel. Within hours, the new state was at war with Arab countries surrounding it.
The Arab states were Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon.
Technically speaking, Lebanon announced its participation in the 1948 war shortly after Israel's declaration of independence and basically the collapse of Palestinian society and the end of what was called the civil war phase, in which Zionist forces were able to effectively rout the Palestinian forces. My name is Ziad Abourish. I'm associate professor of human rights at Bard College in New York, and I am the author of The State of Lebanon, which was published in March 2026. However, I think it's important to note that the Lebanese army took up a primarily defensive posture during the war. So most historians would argue that Lebanon's participation in the 1948 war was largely to save face and maintain consistent coalition politics with other Arab states.
Lebanon is in a complicated position because it finds itself between the Arab world and the West. My name is Dan Naor, and I'm an historian of modern Lebanese history.
Dan is also a lecturer in the Department of Middle East Studies at Ariel University in Israel.
Parts of Lebanon, parts of the Lebanese communities, were willing to accept Israel, especially the Christian communities, but they cannot do it publicly because they had to take into account the Arab world opinion. Lebanon cannot confront the Arab world.
While Lebanon was not a key player in the 1948 war, it was impacted by the influx of Palestinian refugees.
Over 800,000 Palestinians were forced out of their homes. Homes were burned down, children were killed. And this is why we ended up with a huge Palestinian refugee crisis in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, because those who were dispossessed out of their lands had to walk to neighboring countries. And this is why there was this opposition to the birth of Israel.
Many refugees came to Lebanon, as well as the other Arab states. But in Lebanon, there was the problem of the communities or the balance of power. Most of the refugees were Sunnites and not Christians, or Shiites were minority within these refugees. And Lebanon was afraid that these influx will affect the balance of power between the communities. So they're not naturalizing them. They are not citizens of Lebanon.
Lebanon is a very interesting place in terms of the ethnic diversity it has, but also the religious diversity it has. Lebanon is composed of 18 religious communities. 11 are actually Christian, 5 are Muslim, 1 Jewish community. What's interesting is that no one religion holds a majority, and that is a fact back then, and it remains a fact today. Now, back then in the 1940s, the political hegemony was established by the Christian Maronites. The Maronites are a sect of Catholicism in Mount Lebanon. They were the golden children of France. There was a lot of collaboration between the Maronites of Mount Lebanon and the French colonial powers. So fast forward after the independence, this hegemony of the Maronite upper class translated into pulling a lot of resources into the city of Beirut and major cities in Lebanon that are predominantly either Christian or Muslim Sunni. And so there were parts of Lebanon that were heavily ignored. Infrastructure, schooling, healthcare. So when the Palestinian refugees who were dispossessed entered Lebanon, at first they were predominantly in the south of the country. And the south of the country was already poor because the state was not interested in investing in it. So there was no more balance between a poor south and the very rich Beirut.
The political system in Lebanon is based on a confessional sectarian model of governance where political seats in parliaments and elsewhere are allocated on the basis of religion and sect. But the actual position of various Lebanese groups and individuals towards the Palestinian refugees was never a fixed dynamic. So, for example, there were political parties and politicians in Lebanon that prior to 1948 were part of the formal anti-Zionist coalition that had formed in Lebanon to oppose Jewish European immigration to Palestine and the establishment of a Jewish state. And they continued to express that opposition after 1948. And they had a rather supportive position towards the Palestinian refugees initially. However, as time went on and the situation of Palestinian refugees turned from what we could call a temporary emergency into a permanent condition, and there were various Israeli, US, and other plans to attempt to resettle the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, that's when you had a very different orientation to the question of Palestinian refugees.
The situation in Beirut is clearly getting worse as the factional fighting continues.
Several suburbs are now battlegrounds, with buildings on fire, much of the city and several suburbs are in the hands of one or another of the warring factions.
Between 1975 and 1990, a sectarian civil war raged across Lebanon. The newly arrived Palestinian refugees, while not the cause, did play a role in the civil war.
In the 1940s up to the 1970s, Lebanon was compared to the Switzerland or Paris of the Middle East. But also there were places that were incredibly poor. And this translated, unfortunately, into not only a wealth division between the wealthy and the poor, but it also translated into religious and sectarian violence. In other words, the Muslims, predominantly in the south, saw in the Christians in the north as very colonial, pro-West Western values. They're partying, they're having fun, they're ignoring what's happening to their Muslim brothers, the Palestinians. So it quickly translated into Muslim versus Christian, Palestinian versus Lebanese, and this is what led to the war. Now, it's important to recognize that there are Lebanese Christians that actually stood by the Palestinian cause, but overall, the entering of the Palestinians into Lebanon divided the Lebanese public opinion between those who were in favor of fighting Israel and supporting the Palestinian cause. And that took the shape of basically the Muslim resistance. And those who thought of self-preservation and continuing the golden age of Lebanon and keeping Lebanon as pro-Western.
But the Lebanese civil war did not happen in a vacuum. In 1967, another war broke out between a coalition of Arab states and Israel, known as the Six-Day War. While Lebanon didn't directly take part, the war did result in the politicization of Palestinians living across the Middle East and in Lebanon.
I can say generally that the Palestinian refugees, well, they sat quiet until 1967. And I will explain why. Because until 1967, the Palestinian cause was under the leadership of the Arab world, especially Egypt, of Gamal Abdel Nasser. The Arab world or the Arab states created the PLO in 1964. And it was meant that this organization will do what the Arab world want them to do. But after the 1967 war, when the Arab states were defeated, then the Palestinians said, we cannot count on the Arab world. We had to count on ourselves.
As many historians have pointed out, in 1967, during the Six-Day War, not only was the remainder of historic Palestine occupied by Israel, but so was the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt and the Golan Heights. It represented a colossal defeat for Arab militaries, and it only fueled further the idea that Palestinians would have to become more actively and directly engaged in their own liberation struggle. This was the case in Jordan, in Syria, and it was equally the case in Lebanon.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince. And today, the story of Lebanon and its relationship with Israel. In the 1970s, southern Lebanon became the epicenter of Palestinian resistance. It took on the form of ongoing raids across the border into Israel.
It wasn't until the 1970s where Palestinian resistance operations and military operations across the border with Israel began to really take off. And that was a result of the fact that initially the primary fronts with Israel were via Jordan and via Syria. But after the 1967 war, and after in particular the expulsion of Palestinian guerrilla groups and fighters from Jordan in 1970 and 71, Lebanon became their new primary base of operations, and the Lebanon border became the new primary front of Palestinian resistance operations.
They began to fight Israel, to make terror attacks against the Israeli citizens, and from that point on, there is a state of a war, I can say, between Lebanon and Israel, or not between Lebanon as a state, but between Israel and segments within Lebanon.
Israel invaded Lebanon in March of 1978 with the specific objective of destroying the Palestinian resistance movements that had primarily taken up bases in South Lebanon. However, I think it's also important to recognize that Israel itself had long had various territorial ambitions in southern Lebanon, and that contingency planning within the Israeli military for various invasions and occupations of South Lebanon actually long preceded the 1978 invasion.
After the 1978 invasion, Israel did not fully withdraw. And in 1982, they launched a much larger invasion, this time reaching Beirut.
If the rest of the world doubted the correctness of Israel's military lunge into Lebanon, there was no doubt at all in the minds of the Israeli leadership that what they'd embarked upon was necessary and justifiable.
by 1982, Israel had clearly made the decision that it wanted to both destroy the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was the umbrella organization and primary political leadership of the Palestinian people. And this time did not just invade South Lebanon, but proceeded all the way to Beirut and imposed a brutal siege of West Beirut, where the PLO was primarily centered. And of course, this was until there was a negotiated expulsion of the PLO, where Yasser Arafat and most of the PLO leadership and fighters were evacuated from Beirut and from Lebanon. But as your question hints at, replacing or removing the PLO did not address the core issues of Israel's relationship with Lebanon or Israel's relationship with the Palestinians. In fact, it only laid the groundwork for a new and what many would say far more effective resistance organization to emerge in Lebanon. And of course, that is Hezbollah, which emerges between 1982 and 1985.
The emergence of Hezbollah is not just a result of Israel's war against the Palestinian militias. I'm Brigadier General IDF Reserve Asaf Oyon, Senior Fellow at the INSS Tel Aviv, the Institute for National Security Studies, and I'm an International Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The emergence of Hezbollah is part of the rise of the Islamic Republic of Iran, its regional strategy, its obsession with destroying Israel.
The Israeli invasion was just a trigger for the creation of Hezbollah. The seeds were more earlier. The Shiite community began to be more Islamist, I can say, from the late 70s, especially after the Iranian revolution. Iranians and segments within the Shiite community began to think about creating an organization that will represent their Islamist visions. Of course, the prolonged staying on the ground just strengthened Hezbollah and made him more popular within the Shiite community and finally within Lebanon.
The 1982 invasion led to an 18-year military occupation of South Lebanon. Ehud Barak was the Israeli prime minister at the end of this occupation.
In an interview with Ehud Barak with the Time magazine, he said, if Israel had not invaded Lebanon in 1982, Hezbollah would not exist. This is not an endorsement of terrorism in any way, shape, or form, but terrorism is not born out of vacuum. Terrorism is born out of severe violation of human rights, a lack of opportunities, and so on. This is where ideology plays a role to convince people to commit these violent acts, right? The occupation that Israel imposed on Lebanon from basically 1978, but really from 1982 till year 2000, played two roles. The Lebanese people, they were very aware of this occupation and they were very opposed to it. We had several massacres, but the big one was in 1996 when Israel bombed South Lebanon, particularly the village of Qana. And Muslim, just like Christian villagers, were killed. This is to say that the Lebanese people who were not living the occupation, it wasn't like the occupation was out of sight, out of mind, because it was frequently in the news. The other thing is that happened is that when Israel invaded Lebanon, they planted a lot of landmines. So it was very frequent to hear almost on a daily basis in the news, people dying because of landmines. At no point the Lebanese people were in favor of the occupation of South Lebanon.
The occupation ended in 2000 with the withdrawal of the Israeli army, and many Lebanese believed they were forced to withdraw because of Hezbollah's resistance.
There is no doubt that Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon in May 2000 was primarily, first and foremost, a direct result of the guerrilla insurgency that Hezbollah had waged against the Israeli occupation. Perhaps the only instance of a local Arab organization or state being capable to force the withdrawal of Israel from territories it occupied. Israel continues to occupy the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank, all seized in 1967. Israel continues to occupy the Golan Heights and, in fact, annex the Golan Heights. Lebanon is perhaps the only case in 2000 where we had this situation of a forced withdrawal of the Israelis.
I would argue that the opposite. If it wasn't for Hezbollah, Israel would have very little interest in deploying forces into Lebanon. It has no territorial claims. It has no water demands. To begin with, if Lebanon wouldn't be threatening Israel through its lack of control over what's happening in its territory, and it's being a fertile ground for growth of terror threats, PLO, Hezbollah, and so on and so forth, Israel would never been interested there. Actually, in 2000, when we withdrew, we were unwise enough to decrease our attention level to Lebanon, thinking that the threat is lesser.
Hezbollah had started to engage in Lebanese politics in the early 1990s, and its popularity only increased after Israel withdrew in 2000. But Hezbollah did not disarm, and this presented a challenge to the Lebanese state.
We know that Hezbollah has its own agenda. Hezbollah was born with the ideology and commitment to the supreme leader of Iran. In its manifesto in 1985, it literally pledged allegiance to the supreme leader of Iran. And also in their manifesto, they called for the destruction of the Jewish people. And while we can look at Hezbollah as a potentially a force that is opposing occupation, it was also not an innocent movement. They had their own agenda. And so how did this translate into creating a headache for the state of Lebanon? When Lebanese civil war ended in 1991, Lebanon adopted an amnesty law that called for the forgiving and forgetting all the crimes that happened during the civil war. However, if you read the Taif agreement that basically ended the war, talks about the right for Lebanon to resist oppression and occupation. It does not name Hezbollah. So in doing so, in 1991, Lebanon, without perhaps intending to do so, legalized a militia. And in doing so, Hezbollah started infiltrating the parliament and then the government. So they went from a fighting community to being a legalized entity. So they ran for election in 1992, first time. They won 8 seats in the parliament. Fast forward, they entered the government in 2008. This is not to say that Hezbollah, meanwhile, from 2000 onward, there were more and more talks in Lebanon to disarm Hezbollah, very hushed, because Hezbollah at the time was a huge power. In 2008, the Lebanese government wanted to remove Hezbollah members from the airport. They controlled all communication in the airport. And this is where it created an issue between Hezbollah and the state of Lebanon. And Hezbollah turned its weapons inside Lebanon and killed Lebanese. And that was the moment where for 3 days, everybody was holding their breath because there was a fear of going into a civil war. Why am I saying all of this? Because on the one hand, the state of Lebanon legalized Hezbollah. On the other hand, the state of Lebanon became aware that it created a monster that it cannot control. On the other hand, Israel was occupying a Lebanese territory and still is today. Lebanon as a state cannot oppose Hezbollah because it's sure to turn into sectarian violence. So it's really, really a complicated, hard situation to do that. But no doubt that there is definitely responsibility on the state of Lebanon for allowing this to happen.
Israel and Gaza are at war again. Palestinian gunmen have crossed into Israel, opening fire on civilians in a surprise dawn attack.
After the October 7 terrorist attacks on Israel in 2023, Hezbollah had to decide if it would join Hamas and drag Lebanon into a full-scale war. To the surprise of many, its response was measured.
Hezbollah is a dynamic strategic actor that has to navigate and balance between its domestic constituents and its transnational alliances with groups like Hamas, as well as its relationship with Iran. We know now, for example, that there actually was a very intense internal debate within the top echelons of Hezbollah of whether or not Hezbollah should enter the fray, so to speak, and to what extent. And while Hezbollah officially opened what it called a support front on October 8, 2023, there were other elements within the top leadership of Hezbollah that wanted Hezbollah to do more. For me, what Hezbollah did after October 7th simply proved the point that Hezbollah is an organic organization within Lebanon that is accountable to its constituency internally and is trying to balance its various relationships with outside groups and outside powers.
Hamas jump-started an Iranian vision of attacking Israel from all around. However, the timing was a surprise to most of the axis of resistance. So Iran was careful not to get in. Hezbollah was careful not to be drawn too much. So it thought it could be playing a more limited role. So I think throughout, until his death, Hassan Nasrallah thought he could square the circle and manage the fire in a way that will not take him to a full-scale war with Israel, which he feared. So he made everything possible to use only a symbolic or partial force of his full capacity. Israel, during that time, since he joined the war on October 8th, Israel went through a process in which the first part was defensive, 11 months, and then it went into something that looked like a gradual all-out war, but in phases. So by the time Hezbollah appreciated and by the time Nasrallah recognized that he's in the full-scale war, he was already dead and most of his capabilities were gone.
Israel had a openly declared objective of destroying Hezbollah, which undoubtedly would have to involve not just the indiscriminate aerial and artillery bombing campaign we have seen by Israel in Lebanon, but also a ground invasion. There are entire villages which were demolished and detonated during the Israeli invasion and occupation of parts of South Lebanon, which continue until today. And whatever criticisms people might have of Hezbollah, and there are many, they pale in comparison to what they think about Israel and its conduct in southern Lebanon and in Beirut and other parts of the country.
What Israel did after October 7th is said, okay, if this is military, regardless of what is other civilian use, we will take it out. We will raise it. We will not enable Hezbollah's reusing it later. And to make sure that the collateral is lower, the population is evacuated for its safety. You can say, okay, they're deported from their homes. It's true. But when you bring military activity into your home, don't be surprised if you are a collateral. In this sense, the return of those deported and the reconstruction of the villages will be conditioned on one thing, that the Lebanese government assures that it's not being reused and rebuilt for Hezbollah purposes, for military purposes. And then they can come and live in peace. But as long as they adopt the resistance as part of their daily life, you know, we have a living room, kitchen, dining room, and a missile room, that cannot pass. Chairman Mao said that the guerrilla swims among the population like fish in the sea. Israel, in this chapter after October 7, decided to dry up the sea.
There's no doubt that Israel is occupying Lebanon. There's no doubt that there's violation of international law. On the other hand, for Israel to claim that it's cleaning Lebanon of terrorism, I agree, it's not its job. On the other hand, Hezbollah is forcing decisions on the Lebanese people, that these decisions were never voted on in parliament. They never were collectively discussed. But definitely, it's not up to Israel to decide the fate of the Lebanese people.
If there's one thing I would say about any agreement or thinking about the long history of Israel-Lebanon relationships, it's impossible to imagine a meaningful, lasting agreement between Lebanon and Israel that does not address the fundamental orientation that Israel has towards Lebanon, let alone towards the Palestinian people. And that is the real problem with this agreement and the types of agreement that are trying to be built around it.
Thanks to all today's guests, whose details you can find on the Rear Vision website. Thanks also to the sound engineer, Isabella Tropiano. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.